Welcome to the Feeling Good Podcast. Hello, I am your host, Fabrice Nye. And joining me here in the Murrieta Studios is the creator of the team model, Dr. David Burns. Hi, David.
Hi, Fabrice.
So today, we're going to talk about the second letter in TEAM, and E for empathy. And I think that you wanted to start us with a little story. So why don't you go ahead, David?
Well, after I began using cognitive therapy, I think we talked last time, I left my career in biological psychiatry and decided to go into clinical practice using cognitive therapy because I was just so excited about seeing people recover who I'd been stuck with. It was a fantastic experience. And I was really good at technical stuff early on. I learned a lot of methods from Beck. I created a lot of methods. And I used to have the idea that if I just had enough therapy methods, I could help anybody. Mm-hmm. But there were always some patients that I couldn't quite connect with. There was some kind of missing piece there. No matter how many methods I used, that there was always some tension, some resistance, some power struggle going on.
Right.
Well, one day, Tim Beck, that's what we used to call him, Tim. That was kind of his nickname. His real name is Aaron Beck. He called me. He had his Center for Cognitive Therapy on the fifth floor of the Girard Bank Building, mm-hmm. right across from the university. I had my private practice on the third floor, and for my volunteer work for the university, I used to kind of help teach people cognitive therapy. And one day he called and said, "David, listen, I've got this problem I want you to help me with. There's this young man from England, Sterling Morey. He's a medical student. And when I was over in London, I gave a talk at the Maudsley, and then he came up and said, could I come and do my month psychiatry practicum training at your clinic, your Center for Cognitive Therapy in Philadelphia?" And I told him, "Oh, no problem, come on over." And then I forgot all about it, and he just showed up this morning for his month of training, and we don't have anything to offer him.
Yeah, so out of the blue like that.
Yeah, so I told him that he could sit in with you and watch you doing therapy during the month, and that would be a good like training experience for him. And I was just shocked at that because I was doing private practice; patients were paying me for sessions,
right. And so it was a bit intrusive.
Oh, absolutely! They wouldn't want some medical student sitting, you know, watching.
Yeah,
but I didn't want to let down a colleague. So I said, "Well, I don't know if that's going to work in, you know, a private practice setting, but maybe he could come down and sit in for one or two sessions, and then I'll see how it goes. And if the patients don't like it, then, you know, maybe I can't offer more than that." So Tim said, "Well, that's a good start. I'll send him right down." So he got on the elevator and came down, and 1 minute later he was there in my office, and he told me that he was. He was really a nice guy, but he said he was very nervous and insecure because he hadn't had any psychology in college, and he'd had no psychiatry training in his medical school yet. So he said he just wanted to sit in a corner and watch so that the patient wouldn't notice that he didn't know anything. And I said, "Sterling, that's going to be awfully awkward. We'll sit like we have like kind of chairs like the ones we're sitting in now, you know, nice kind of living room type chairs, and we'll have three of them, and we'll sit in a circle. But don't worry, I'll
fill in the blanks.
Yeah, I'll carry the ball. I won't put you on the spot or anything like that." So he was really nervous, but he was okay for that. Well, the next patient who came in was a very sad fellow. He was a university student who had severe paranoid schizophrenia, and he'd been referred by the authorities because he was screaming in the dormitory in the middle of the night, and he had written the word death on his dormitory door. Mm. The other kids were afraid of him, and his problem was that he was hallucinating that his sexual thoughts were being broadcast out loud in campus, and so he was very enraged about this.
Yeah,
I was really stuck with him. I thought, well, it couldn't hurt to have somebody sit in. And so we'll just call him John. I said, "You know, John Sterling is a medical student from England, and what would you think if he were could maybe sit in on the session and he could kind of, you know, help us and work along with us. And John got all excited. He thought he was a special messenger sent from London just to help with his therapy. And so he.
So that worked out well.
Yeah, so we went in and sat down, and then the patients, John started, you know, shouting, and he says, Dr. Burns, when I was on the way to the your office this morning, I went past the Episcopal Church, and the door was open. I knew there was a special purpose for that door being open, so I looked inside, and there was John the Baptist, and he had been sent by Jesus from heaven to the earth to be a special messenger with secrets about the spiritual future of the human race, and I was the one who was supposed to receive these secrets from John the Baptist so I could disseminate them to all the peoples in the world. But John the Baptist started telling me these secrets about the spiritual future of the human race, and the minister saw us, and he got jealous because John the Baptist didn't want to speak with him. So he called the police, and they evicted me, and they told me I'm not allowed to go back in that church again. And there's a conspiracy to prevent me from seeing John the Baptist, and what do you intend to do about it, Dr. Burns? And I was taken aback. This was how the sessions went. And yeah. I felt like saying, I know you're not taking your Thorazine, you know, we're going to have to up the dose,
right, up the dose, yeah,
medication, that type of thing. But this, I was absolutely stuck with this guy, so I turned to Sterling, and I said, tell me, Sterling, what would be the British approach here? And Sterling was totally panicked, and he didn't say a thing, and his eyes were like spinning in his eye sockets. And he didn't say anything for about, maybe 15, 20, 25 seconds.
Which is a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And the patient got more and more excited, like, what's this expert from London going to say? And finally, Sterling leaned forward and he said, well, John, you know, in England, we have a great interest in religion. And I even took two religion courses in college. And if John the Baptist had secrets about the spiritual future of the human race, I'd want to know what they are. What did John the Baptist tell you? And the patient, John, said, you really want to know? And Sterling said, yes, I'm dying to find out. Tell me what he told you. So they started dialoguing, and I was entirely shut out of the session, and they seemed very excited, like old friends. And the fellow, the patient, started to sound more and more, you know, reasonable and less bizarre.
Yeah, and he was being heard suddenly.
Yeah, he was being heard. And about a half of the way through the session, the patient turned to me and said, Dr. Morey, started calling him doctor at this point. Dr. Morey's helping me so much. And I'm asking myself, really? What's he doing? How's this guy working?
He's just furthering your psychosis right now.
Yeah. So patient turned to Sterling and said, Dr. Moore, you helped me so much with that religion problem, but I have another problem maybe you can help me with. And then Sterling said, oh, yes, I can help you with anything. What's your other problem?
You got emboldened by then.
Yeah, right. And the patient said, John said, well, my other problem is I'm horny all the time. And Sterling said, well, why is that a problem for you? And the fellow sadly said, well, you see, I don't know how to talk to girls, and I don't know how to talk to guys either. In fact, you know, I don't have a friend in the world. And everywhere I go, I can hear people talking about me, and they're saying he's crazy. He has schizophrenia, and I don't have anything in common with people. I always notice everywhere how different I am from everyone. And then Sterling said, "You know, you're right. I noticed that about you right away. Something I noticed." And the patient said, "Well, what did you notice about me?" Sterling said, "I noticed that you are quite different from everybody, and I'll bet you just go around all the time noticing what's different between you and other people and how you don't have anything in common with anybody." And the patient said, "You're right. How did you know that about me?" And I'm thinking, well, you just told him, Tommy. He's just repeating back what you told him. And And Sterling said, "And there's something else I've noticed about you too, that I think I know about you." The patient said, "What's that?" He says, "I'll bet you don't bother to notice what you do have in common with people. Like you and I, what we have in common is an interest in religion. And when we talk about religion, we have a great time." And then the patient said, "You know, you're right. I never thought of that before. Where do you think I could find some real horny girls I have something in common with?" So we started talking about that. And then at the end of the session, the patient turned to me and says, "So, Dr. Burns, this is by far the best session we ever had. Will Dr. Morey be here next week?"
And you said?
I said, "He'll be here the whole month." And so I decided to ask Sterling to sit in with me on all of my sessions. I was seeing, at that time, 70 hours of therapy a week.
Uh-huh.
And it was the most fantastic month of my career, really. And I was teaching Sterling high-powered cognitive therapy techniques, but I was spying on him and learning from him, because I said, this guy's got something that I don't have. Because any time I was stuck with a patient, a raging, angry, critical patient, I would just say, "Sterling, what would be your approach?" And within 15 to 30 seconds, he'd have the patient sobbing in a friendly way and eating out of his hands. And so I told myself, he's got something that I don't have, and I'm going to learn as best I can to do what he's doing, because this is one of the missing links in my therapy. And that was one of the first times I really decided to make a concerted effort not only to do research on therapeutic empathy, but to develop training methods so I could teach myself, figure out how he and others who have gifts at personal relationships, how they do that, what rules they follow, what methods they use.
Could you tell at the time what it was that he was doing? Could you tell what he had that you didn't feel you had?
Yes. What I would do is each time he would have this fantastic interaction with somebody who had been spiraling out of control with anger or hopelessness or anxiety or whatever, I would say, "Now, what did he do?" And I would try to give it a name. And so I came up with what I call the five secrets of effective communication. And I first just put them on a list and defined them so I'd know what the techniques are. And then after that, I developed training methods so I could learn them. And then so the people in my clinic and other people in my workshops can learn to do that also.
You know, I find this fascinating because, you know, I've read a number of your books and I've heard you tell a number of stories, and I can see how all the things that you have come up with have come from your own personal experience in different clinical settings and with other clinicians, like in this case with this Sterling Morey. I know that when I came to the team model myself, the part about empathy seemed to me like it was like a matter of course thing. You know, a lot of studies talk about how the so-called therapeutic alliance is one of the major factors in how people get better, and the techniques themselves are really accessory. But I felt, you know, I know empathy. I know how to empathize with people. I'm a kind of an empathic kind of guy. And what does this have to teach me? And I found that what I was calling empathy was certainly empathic, but was not very systematic. And so I'm wondering what's specific about what you call empathy in this model.
Well, one of the important issues that we mentioned last time is that we actually measure empathy at the end of every session.
Oh, yeah. Well, we talked about testing that in the last podcast.
Yeah. And what clinicians find out is that they get really poor empathy scores from patients initially, you know, failing grades from at least 50% of your patients.
And most, not me.
Yeah. And most clinicians will get 100% failing grades. As it turns out, clinicians think they're very empathic, and then when they use the assessment test, they find out their empathy skills are poor. And then to prove it, I use role play techniques where we have one person play the role of a difficult client and criticize the therapist. Then the therapist responds as effectively as he or she can, and then we give the therapist a grade. Was it an A, a B, a C, a D? And what did the therapist do right? And what did the therapist do wrong? And it's a shock to clinicians that their skills are extremely poor. For example, I was in Edmonton, Canada, yesterday and the day before, or Monday and Tuesday, actually, doing a workshop for mental health professionals. And when I did this demonstration, I asked for two volunteers from the audience, and I said, don't come up here if you've got a big ego, because you're going to find out things about yourself that are pretty disturbing about your empathy skills. And so this really good-natured psychiatrist came up, a really friendly, nice guy, and then a woman, I think she was a clinical social worker or a psychologist,
right,
came up, and she played the role of the difficult patient.
So she was acting out. It was not really herself.
No, she was just a role play demonstration.
Yeah.
But the idea behind it is, if you can empathize with a really critical, aggressive client who's angry with you, then you can use the same skills, these five secrets of effective communication, with any client. So I explained how it went, and so she played the role of some teenager who said something like, oh, you're just like my parents, you're trying to tell me what to do, and I don't really want to be here, and I'd like to drop out of this therapy, and you don't understand me, and you don't really like me, and you're not really helping me, you're just trying to control me.
Yeah.
And then he was supposed to respond with the five secrets of effective communication, to find truth in what she was saying, to acknowledge her feelings.
You keep mentioning those so-called five secrets. We haven't talked about that, but since you're referring to them, can you very briefly say what that means?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're organized under EAR. E is empathy, A is assertiveness, R is respect. I say learn to speak with your ear,
okay.
EAR. Now, the three empathy skills are, one is the disarming technique, and that's to find truth in what the other person is saying, even if it doesn't seem reasonable to you, even if it seems illogical or distorted or unfair.
Right.
And that's the hardest and most powerful of all of the techniques. In fact, that's what Sterling did a lot. You see, when this young man was saying, I saw John the Baptist, my thought was, no, you didn't. You're hallucinating. You have a brain disorder. You need more medication. And that's not a message that people want to hear. It's kind of hurtful, insulting.
Yeah.
And Sterling found truth. He said, oh, wow, you have secrets about the spiritual future of the human race from John the Baptist. That's important. The human race is in a spiritual crisis. What did John the Baptist tell you? What's your thinking? I want to hear about it. You're important. This is important.
Yeah.
You see, so
you're going the same direction as the client.
Yeah. You see the truth in what the client is saying, but it's hard for therapists to do that, particularly when we're criticized by patients.
Sure.
Because it's embarrassing to have to, and patients' criticisms are always contain a lot of truth.
Right.
The second technique, and these aren't done in any order, these aren't formulas, these are just like the names of the techniques, but the second one is called empathy, and there's thought empathy and feeling empathy. Thought empathy is simply repeating the patient's words so the patient can see that you got it. And most therapists say, oh, I can do that.
Right.
But therapists actually cannot do that when you're under attack. The therapist will get so panicky and anxious that you start rehearsing what you're going to say next, and by the time the patient finishes, it's very rare that a therapist would be able to say what you just said was A, B, and C.
Right, because they were maybe too stressed by trying to respond to what the client is saying.
That's right, and then you respond in a go off in right angles.
Yeah,
that doesn't take into account what the patient just said to you, and then the patient gets more irritated and escalates because you didn't get it. That's thought empathy. Feeling, and again, people if their therapist listening to this, they'll think, oh, I can do these things, but you actually, most therapists can't. That you think you can, but you can't when put to the test in an actual demonstration of your therapy skills. Feeling empathy is acknowledging the patient's feelings, given what the patient just said. Like, for example, in the stage demonstration in Edmonton, you know, the patient said, you know, you're trying to control me, you're not helping me, you don't care about me, you're just like my parents.
Yeah.
Well, the feelings here would be anger and hurt and disappointment. You know,
resentment.
Absolutely. So given what the patient says, I can imagine you might be feeling A, B, and C. And then inquiry would be, can you tell me more about that? I want to hear more about what you're saying. This is incredibly important. So the three listening skills are the disarming technique, thought and feeling empathy, and inquiry. Then the EAR, A is assertiveness, and the assertiveness skill is I feel statements. That's where the therapist expresses his or her feelings in a professional but open way. The formula here is I'm feeling X. Like you might say something like I'm feeling kind of stunned by what you're saying, Susan. Something like that would be an I feel statement.
Right.
And this is
hard. What if you feel angry at your patient?
You can express anger. You can express any feeling if you do it in a warm way that will not frighten the patient or cause them to lose face.
When I feel angry at my patient, I may not feel very warm toward them. So how do you do that?
Can we come back to that in a minute?
Sure.
And I'll give you a good example of how you can express really tough patience, like when you're angry with someone or you don't like the patient, how you can do that in a way that the patient will really, really like. It's an art form.
All right.
But let me just mention the last skill, because it's often combined with I feel statements, which is respect, empathy, assertiveness, respect. It's to convey some liking, some respect. You can express anything you want, but the theologian Martin Buber talked about I thou statements versus I it statements. You know, when you're angry, you can share it in a respectful way, or you can attack the other person, to belittle the other person, or express your feelings in a competitive way. One of the hardest that I ever had, you know, therapists often say, how do you express anger to patients? So what if you don't like a patient? How do you express that?
Yeah.
One of the toughest I ever had was a young man. Parents referred him. He was about 23 years old, and he was an alcoholic, and they thought he was kind of depressed and lonely. He was a construction laborer, and he would come to sessions smelling of urine. And I don't know how often he bathed, but we had cloth furniture like this. And so then after the session, the office would stink.
Yeah.
And my next patient would think I must have peed in my pants or something like that. Mm-hmm. It would take a whole week for the smell to clear out, and then he'd come in for another session and stink it up.
Yeah.
And then in addition, he didn't do any psychotherapy homework, and all he talked about is how much fun it would be for him and me to get drunk and go out raping women in the evenings.
Wow.
And it was very disturbing to me, and I was, you know, angry with him, and I was not liking him, and I was wishing I could get rid of him.
Yeah.
And one of my rules is you always have to tell the patient when you have these kinds of feelings, but to do it in a loving way, in a respectful way. And I said to myself, how in the world am I going to tell this guy this? But I've got to tell him. But it was very anxiety provoking for me. And you know, after a few weeks, I said, I've got to do it. I can't let this thing continue like this. And so he came in, you know, for his fourth session, and I said, you know, Peter, I have something I want to share with you. It's going to sound a little tough, a little harsh, and I want you to know my goal is to enhance our relationship. I definitely am not trying to scare you off at all. I'm not trying to push you away. But is it okay if I tell you something that I've kind of been feeling and noticing? And he says, yeah, that's okay, doctor. And I said, you know. I don't know how often you bathe or if you're aware of this, but you have a kind of a strong smell of urine when you come in, and it then stays on the furniture after you leave, and other patients comment on it, and it takes quite a few days for the smell to clear out. That's been bothering me. And then in addition, you haven't done any of the psychotherapy homework. You really haven't asked for my help with anything. You just talk about how fun it would be for you and me to go out raping women at night and getting drunk together. And I don't know if you've thought about the impact of what you're saying on me, but it's been a problem for me, and I've been finding myself being angry with you and not liking you, and I've even wished that you would drop out of therapy, and I've been thinking, I really want to get rid of this guy. I don't like him. I want to get rid of him. And then I thought, wow, that's really neat. This is the best thing that could happen. And he said, why is that the best thing that could happen? He says, well, I said, because your parents sent you here because you're lonely, because you don't have friends, because you can't connect with people. And here I actually kind of like you in spite of how annoyed I am. And yet I'm trying to get rid of you. And I thought, well, this is the very problem that you came for help with. And so if we talk about it and connect, that might be an important part of the solution to that problem of your loneliness and you know, not
you did
close
a sort
to
of
people.
of reframing.
Yeah, yeah. To reframe it in a positive, flattering way. Mm-hmm. And he took it just fine. He came back the next week. He was all cleaned up. He'd done his psychotherapy homework, and he became a really pleasant guy to work with. I developed a tremendous fondness for him.
Now, what I notice is that you're not just telling him what you feel toward him, but you're also telling what you think about him. Things like, you know, he's stinking of urine. He doesn't do his therapy homework. So you're not just saying, well, I'm feeling, embarrassed or repulsed or whatever. You're also saying what he is doing that's triggering those
Well,
those
that's
feelings.
True, but I think the crucial thing here is that as the therapist, we're there for the patient. And so they're not there to help you. You're there to help them. And so you have to express yourself as a therapist in a way that will be kind and helpful to the patient,
yeah,
and well received by the patient. It's not like psychodrama or something where you shout at people and get your feelings out and expect some magic,
sure,
to result from that.
So we were on the five secrets. Did you cover all five?
Yep,
I was not keeping count.
the three listening skills, which is the disarming technique, thought and feeling, empathy, and inquiry.
Huh.
And then the assertiveness skill.
Oh, so what was the inquiry? I missed that.
Well, inquiry is to ask gentle, probing questions to find out more about what the patient is thinking and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
The assertiveness skill is the I feel the statements. That was one of the tools I used with this young man.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I combined it with stroking.
Okay.
And that's respect.
All
so
right.
You've got disarming, thought and feeling, empathy, inquiry, I feel statements,
okay,
and stroking. Those are the five secrets.
So it's interesting. I see that kind of like as a Russian doll type thing, because the whole thing we're talking about today is empathy. So E for empathy. But inside you have those five secrets, and one of the EAR section is E for empathy. So there's empathy inside of empathy.
Yeah, that's true.
And then inside of that section, you have three techniques, one of which is empathy.
Right.
which you can then further subdivide into thought empathy and feeling empathy.
I think it's important to operationalize things to where they're clearly defined. One of the things when I first got into cognitive therapy was one of the ideas we had was to take the mysterious and to make it knowable.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people just think of empathy as some vague mysterious thing that you have or don't have.
Well, I'm wondering, some people out there who have not really encountered the model may think, well, I can do empathy. I mean, this is no mystery for me, and I don't need to have it, you know, turned into an algorithm.
Yeah, right, exactly. And when I do workshops too, people are thinking, I know this, I want the advanced stuff, I learned this in graduate school. And that's why I do the techniques like the one I was referring to earlier in the interview in Edmonton. And this
oh, yeah, so we kind of interrupted that story there.
Yeah, so we'll get back to that. So anyway, the young woman was saying to the psychiatrist, you know, you're trying to control me like my parents, and,
yeah,
you know, blah, 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 and I want to drop out of therapy, and this is going nowhere. And then he responded, and he gave kind of a lecture, a friendly lecture, like, I'm just doing this for your own good, and your parents just want the best for you, and on like that. He didn't repeat what she had said. He didn't acknowledge the truth and what she said. In fact, he was continuing to do that controlling behavior in the role play, even though it was just a role play.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't acknowledge her anger. He didn't share his own feelings. He didn't use inquiry. He didn't use any of the five secrets, even though that's what he thought he was doing.
Yeah.
And then I asked him, what grade do you think that you got here? He said, oh, B plus. I'm pretty good. I did pretty good at that. I think he was being falsely modest. I think he thought he'd gotten an A.
Right.
And then I said to the woman, you know, what grade did you give him? And she said, well, out of politeness, I'd maybe give him a D minus.
Wow.
And then asked the people in the audience, you know, and they all, how many gave an A, you know, hands went up, how many gave a B, a couple of hands went up, how many gave a C or below, and all the hands went up.
And before you did that, did you actually teach them what your, you know, concept of empathy was like?
Yeah, and they thought they understood
sort of,
it.
Yeah.
And then this was saying, but you can't understand it from a lecture, and you didn't learn it in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is an exercise, and if you do this exercise 10 or 15 times, you'll suddenly get it.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to learn, and learning it requires three things.
Okay.
The
what
first,
is that?
Well, the first one is a tremendous hunger. And, huh, you know, that's what I had early in my career. I saw what Sterling was doing, and I realized that I had a lot to offer, but there were missing pieces. And I said, I want that. I want what he's got. I want it in my relationships with my patients. I want it in my relationships with my colleagues like Fabrice and the people in my Tuesday group. And with my wife, I want it. With my kids, I want it. So you have to have that strong desire. And people who are narcissistic or thinking, you know, I'm good at empathy, I don't need this, you know, without that strong desire, you're not going to get it. The second thing you need is a lot of practice with the five secrets, and we can have a future podcast more on the five secrets.
Yeah, that seems necessary.
How they,
yeah,
work and how the training technique works. But you have to work at it over and over again. You can't play piano by pounding on the keys. You've got to practice and work at it if you want to make beautiful music. And it's,
yeah,
exactly the same with the five secrets. They're like the five keys on a musical instrument, and that instrument is the human relationship,
mm-hmm,
or that's the music is the relationship. But you're the instrument, and it needs a lot of practice. And then the third thing that it requires is humility, because patients, and in my case, doing a lot of teaching, your students, if you get feedback, I get empathy type feedback in teaching situations as well, as you,
yeah,
as you know,
right,
and people are going to tell you things about yourself that you don't want to hear, things that are true, that are painful. Your patients will, and your students will. And if you disarm them, if you acknowledge that the truth in what they're saying with warmth and humility, it will, magic will occur, and it will create a tremendous bonding. But that requires the death of the ego, what the Buddhists call the great death, or the Christians call death and resurrection, or being born again, or, you know, different religions have different names for that. I know you have a lot of knowledge of spirituality and things of that nature, but it requires the ability, humility, and it's painful to use the five secrets when you're under attack, when you're being criticized.
Yeah, you have to learn to take criticism and use that for your own good, really.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, the people who are listening to us, some of those who have this hunger, and they want to practice this and learn more, what can they do to do that?
Well, one thing is that my book, Feeling Good Together, is for the general public, but also for therapists, talks all about the five secrets and why people get into failures in relationships, and
yes,
there's a lot of training exercises in there to learn the five secrets through written exercises, and shows how some of the role play techniques work.
Yeah.
And also for therapists, there's a whole section on this in my psychotherapy ebook, which is called Tools, Not Schools of Therapy. There's about five or six or seven chapters on empathy and the five secrets.
And where do you get that?
Well, they would email. Well, they can go to my website, feelinggood.com, and there's order forms for the psychotherapy ebook. And if people want one of my general public books, like Feeling Good Together or Feeling Good, you can order those through Amazon.
Okay. Is there any way to get some training or anything like that?
Yes, there's a lot of training things for mental health professionals. One would be to attend one of my workshops, and they're listed on my website, both two-day workshops like the one I just did on trauma up in Canada, or four-day intensives like I'll be doing in the next couple months, 2 4-day intensives in Canada, and in July, and then in August, the one at the South San Francisco Conference Center, which is kind of the big one each year. It's a really neat one. Another thing is, many of my colleagues, and you might be doing this one day soon also, have developed online, weekly online training groups, Jill Levitt and Angela Crum and a number of others. And they're small groups, for limited to generally 15 mental health professionals.
Yeah.
And they do fabulous training.
And you have a link to those groups on your website?
Yes. And also for those, they can just go directly. Yeah, there's on my website, there's a one-page form that lists all of those groups.
Okay, great.
And the contact person and the phone number and
fantastic,
what time of day they meet and so forth.
Great. Well, I think that that should give people a lot of resources to look more into this. So I want to thank you, David. That was a very interesting podcast. In fact, I was glad to hear that story in all its glory. That was very nice to hear about.
Sterling's still around, by the way. He went back to England.
I know. I Googled him some time ago. Yes, I know he's still working out there.
Yeah, and he's blossomed, as you might imagine, into just a fantastic therapist. Oh,
absolutely,
But now he's got all the technical skills, and he wrote a beautiful book on cognitive therapy for dying patients and cancer patients, terminal patients. A beautiful book.
Well, thank you for talking with me today. So this is the Feeling Good podcast. And again, for more information, you can always go to David's website at feelinggood.com. And we'll see you at the next podcast.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.